You're listening to the Master Passive Income Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Breakthrough Investor Show. My name is Charles Rose Jr., and we will focus on breaking through limitations and barriers to get you to that next level of investing. With me today is William Palmer, my amazing co-host. And in today's episode, our guest will be talking about how he went from military to millionaire through real estate investing.
He'll also talk about capital raising and how he uses direct mail to find deals. Let's get started.
Welcome to the Breakthrough Investor Show, where we guide you to financial freedom and break barriers in your investing to give you the secrets to success. And now, here are your hosts, Charles Rose Jr. and William Palmer.
William, what's up, man? How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Charles. How are you doing today, man?
Man, I am doing just awesome, man. I'm just super excited about the guests that we have today. And I think you and this guest have some great things in common too, right?
Always looking forward to hearing how other prior military guys ended up becoming super successful in real estate, because that's a part of my history also. And so getting to hear how somebody came from a similar background as myself becoming super successful is like fantastic. I really feed off of those kind of stories. So I'm really looking forward to hearing that and how he started the military millionaire. I think this is going to be a great episode.
I think so too, man. And, you know, he's just so, you know, laid back, pretty cool guy. I got to meet him personally at the Real Estate Wealth Builders Conference. And so it's just so amazing to actually meet people in person and to bring, you know, someone who's just so humble and want to help so many people, you know. And in fact, like, you know, it's so cool that he even, you know, does things to help others. He has a podcast. And he also has a book as well, too. He's the author of the No BS Guide to Military Life, How to Build Wealth, Get Promoted, and Achieve Greatness. Isn't that awesome, William?
Yeah, I'll tell you what. I wish I had that when I first got in. I was smart enough not to buy the Mustang that everybody always tells you to go buy. But that would have been great for me at the time. So, yeah, definitely looking forward to maybe touching on that subject a little bit, too, on like what's in the book. So I haven't read it, full disclosure. So I'll have to grab me a copy.
Well, sounds like you got some work to do, man.
Yeah.
I'm just super excited, man. It's so much things to talk about. He's going to introduce himself and share some pretty cool stories. You know, just warning you, he could be a little bit raw sometime, which is great. I love it himself because it's just so awesome, right? And you could feel his words coming through. So, man, I'm just super excited. So without further ado, man, let's welcome to the show David Perret. David, what's up, man?
What's up? How are you guys doing?
Man, we're doing awesome, man. Awesome. I'm here chilling in the Dominican Republic. That's where I'm living right now for a couple of months, but I'll be back in the U.S. Probably next month.
Do you know Jamie Gruber?
I do not know.
Oh man, he runs the GoBundance, the podcast that GoBundance puts out, but he moved to the DR about a year ago.
No way. You have to connect us, man.
Yeah, he's one of the better podcast hosts that I know. So he's a stud.
Oh man, that would be awesome, especially how we're breaking grounds with this new podcast. I'd love to connect with some like-minded people.
Just shoot me a message afterwards. We'll make it happen.
This is Robert. see what I told you all about David. He's so awesome. Just brings so much value. But you know, today isn't about me. Today we want to hear David's story. So David, man, why don't you tell us more about your investing journey and what initially made you want to do it?
Yeah. I mean, the long short is I joined the Marine Corps in 2008 because I didn't have money for school. I didn't know what I wanted to study for school. I didn't like school and I wanted to leave Arkansas. So what better way to leave Arkansas when you don't have money than to, you know, enlist. And I also, you know, I liked adventure and travel and I was like, this will help me out with that. And it did. It was great. You know, first 4 years I saw, I think 13 countries and it was, you know, it was super, super cool. I loved it. I re-enlisted. And in 2015, I was on recruiting duty and I was just kind of, I was in this weird spot where I was working a ton of hours. I didn't hate what I was doing, but I didn't love what I was doing. And I was like, there's not really another option for me unless I take a W-2 somewhere. And a friend of mine handed me Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which, you know, the book that starts it all for everybody. And he was trying to convince me to join Amway, but that didn't work. I ended up thinking real estate looked really cool. So I started reading a whole bunch of books on real estate. And by the end of that year, I'd bought a duplex and I moved into one unit. I rented the other unit and I went from paying, I think I was paying $550 a month for a 2-bed, 1-bath apartment. And then by the time all was said and done, I was out like $175 a month to own this other one. And when I moved out and rented it and it was paying me to own it, I was hooked. So I kind of just went all in. I mean, it took a long time, you know, as Will will tell you, you don't make $1 million in the Marine Corps, especially when you're an E5, you know? And so it took me a long time to save up for that next property. And if it wasn't for like some creative finance stuff, it would have taken me even longer. And then, but it kind of snowballs, you know, so it moves and moves and moves, and then your strategies change and things change. And then, yeah, it's been fun. But yeah, so I bought my first property in 2015. In 2021, I was, on paper millionaire, but I was financially free and able to walk away from the military. So
that's fantastic. So you didn't put any money in the thrift savings plan, or did you pull that out?
Actually, both assumptions are incorrect. I was maxing it out for the past, well, maybe not maxing it. I maxed it out the last 2 years, but I put 10% in on average for the first probably 8 years. And then the last 5, I was trying to put as much as humanly possible into it. And I really wish that I'd known. I mean, it would have twice as much, if not 3 times as much in it right now, if I had just known what funds to put the cash in when I first joined. But I made the stupid mistake of leaving it in bonds like everybody does. And then, I have pulled a loan on it. So there's not as much in it right now, but I'm paying it back. But I don't plan on ever cashing it out. That's kind of my like super duper emergency fund. I know you can roll it into life insurance. You can roll it into, you know, SDI IRAs. Like there's so many options for it. But for me, it's like, I do a ton in real estate. I kind of like having this one little piece of the puzzle that's totally disconnected from real estate, completely passive. Let's be real. A 401k is actually passive, and a real estate investment, not really very many actually passive real estate investments. And it's kind of nice to know that a good chunk of my retirement is going to be covered, you know, whether I ever use it or need it or not.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, I was the opposite. I never put a thing in it and used everything I had, but so other extreme.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's, you know, there's pros and cons to every aspect, right? I think it's like one of those things where if you set it up at 10% or 20% or whatever, when you're in boot camp, you don't even know you're missing the money. So it doesn't,
you have no
idea. It doesn't matter. Yeah. So I never saw that 10%. It always went into the TSP. So it didn't make a difference to me if I, you know, like, oh, well then I'll save for this thing. It didn't feel like I was taking away from something. I just had never seen that money.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's awesome. And the cool thing about that is that just gives you so much more options, right? You have that nest egg sitting there and you have your real estate and investing and everything else that you're doing. So that, I think that's awesome that you're doing that too. I don't know. So I cashed out my 401k a couple of times and took loans from it and paid it back. I still have it sitting there. And so I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to do with it. And so hearing your approach, you know, that sounds really good for me too. You know, maybe I could just let it sit there and grow and just have, you know, have a pot of money for whatever I need it for in the future. You know?
Yeah, I call it my super duper emergency fund. Super. Like I never want to touch it, but if I ever need 6 figures to save my life, I got it.
There you go. I love it.
Pay 10% tax on it, but whatever, you know.
Yeah, but you know, like even when you pay that tax, even if you have to pay a penalty, because I've done that when I cashed out mine before at one point, it's still worth it. You know, what I did with the money, I put it into a real estate asset, and I was just doing some rough math the other day. And because I bought that property with so much equity in it, when I look back at, you know, roughly what I would have had if I left that money in there versus what I have in that just that one property alone, the returns are so much more on it, you know? So,
yeah, depending on how you buy, that can be the case. I tell people, like, don't even think about touching your TSP 401k for money for another investment until you actually have some proof of concept in the other investment. Like, don't risk it when you don't know what's going to happen. But if you're like, dude, I'm crushing it over here and I just need some capital, all right, maybe at that point it makes sense. And I think you only pay the 10% penalty on the gains if you do Roth, right? So, you know, so if I put 60,000 into it and now it's worth 100, I'm really only paying 4% because I'm only paying 10% on the 40. And so, you know, and realistically, even if it is a flat 10% fee on every dollar you pulled out of it, you tell me where you're going to get funded 100K in 1 week for less than a 10% return. Oh, and that's a compounding 10%, not just a one-time fee. So it's like, it's still cheaper money than even most hard money loans. Maybe not right this very moment. Actually, no, especially right this very moment. Maybe not in 2020, 2021, when you could get, you know, 7-8% hard money, but again, that's still compounding and this isn't so.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you borrow the money, you know, that money is going back in, into the account too. Right. And
yeah.
So many options, man. So many things. So man, there's so much, you know, on your journey to talk about, man. And I'm trying to figure out, okay, which angle should we go at, man? You know, one of the reasons why we're starting this podcast is because, you know, many investors, they start investing and then, you know, they reach a point where maybe it's hard to get to that next level. Maybe they don't have enough money. Maybe they have limited mind beliefs. Or maybe, you know what, sometimes they started and didn't turn out too well, right? So many different things can affect an investor from getting to that next level. And often it tends to be mindset challenges. That's what we've realized, right? And so can you share maybe one of the biggest mind challenges you had to go through so that you could break through to become a successful investor?
They pretty much all boil down to just getting out of my own way. It's whether it's imposter syndrome or, you know, having a governor on my life where I don't play all out or just being nervous. But a lot of it's, you know, trying to do everything myself because I'm, you know, afraid to pay people or whatever. It just kind of boiled down to getting out of my own way, like being willing to outsource, being willing to hire, understanding that, you know, imposter syndrome is just you getting out of your comfort zone and that's totally fine. So fucking do it, whatever. I think like those really, they're not the most profound realizations in the world. It's just realizing like, you know, every single entrepreneur you talk to who did something big is like, yeah, I scaled, I hired, I outsourced, I removed myself from this and I stopped doing that. And it's like, that was the hardest part of basically everything I've done. And yet it's ultimately the most rewarding. I mean, I recently hired a new executive assistant, a video editor, a copywriter, and I handed off basically everything other than filming for my content. And, you know, that was a huge piece for me. I'd been doing everything for 5-6 years. And it's a game changer. All I do is one day a week, I film videos and then that's it. I don't worry about content at all. And it's pretty sweet.
Man, you know what? I love how you mentioned moving yourself out of the way. William, I don't think I've heard anyone mention that. We like to ask this question to all of our guests just because it's kind of, you know, the premises, you know, of what this podcast is on, you know, breaking through and overcoming limiting beliefs. But, you know, why do you think that, you know, that was such a hard thing to do to move yourself out of the way? And why do you think it's so hard for other people to do as well?
It's comfortable. Nobody's going to do it as good as you are. And that's true. I mean, you're never going to hire somebody. I mean, okay, let me rephrase that. That does everything as well as you do or cares as much as you do. Maybe you'll find someone, but most likely not, right? They say you should assume that everyone you hire is like 70% as good as you. That's fine though, because if you bring someone in and they do 70% of what you were doing in that area, then you can go and focus on something else. Like, does it like there are important things where it matters, right? Like, I'm not going to outsource my filming of videos, right? Like, it's got to be me. But does it really matter if the person writing my captions is me or is someone who's pretty close to me? And realistically, nobody's been able to tell the difference yet. So, or at least nobody's mentioned it to me. In fact, somebody the other day was like, "Oh man, I love that email you just sent out." And it was a good friend. And I was like, "Oh, cool. I should probably go read it. I don't even know what email we sent out today." And he's like, "Really?" I was like, "Yeah, man, this person's doing it for me now." And he knows the person who's doing it for me. He's like, "Oh, well, that's awesome." It's like, it's a good proof of concept that you being close to me couldn't tell. So, reasonably, you know, yeah, that's what it is. It's hard because it's comfortable. You don't, it's your baby. It's, you know, it's all these things. And then there's like a part of you, especially like, I mean, shit, you were in the Marine Corps. There's this part of you that's like, I can do it. I can do it all.
Yeah.
I'm awesome.
Yeah.
This is great.
You want to own everything.
Yeah. And then when you start letting stuff go, everything seems to work better. As long as you bring in the right people and the right systems.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. I mean, I talked to Charles about like the 80-20 rule. I think I mentioned it once or twice already. But I mean, there are things that I am really, truly bad at and I hate doing. But I don't want to let anyone else do it just because I don't want them to fail. And it's like, if it's my fault I failed, I only have myself to blame kind of thing going on. But if I suck at it anyway, and they're way better at it anyway, it's what they're going to produce is going to be far better than what I could have done myself. So,
Yeah. My video editor is way better than me. Not necessarily because I couldn't do it. I could, but he's better than me. Because I would never spend that much time on each project. And so he is really good. So he probably is better than me, but like, I wouldn't spend that much time on each project. I would get to a point where I'm like, you know,
it's good.
This is the fastest way to get this done. It's good enough. And my content would suffer from it. Whereas in this regard, I just pay the guy and it's done really well and it doesn't take any of my time. In fact, it saves me time. So, you know, granted, that method doesn't work right off the bat when you're not making any money. So, you know, there's an arc to all of this.
So, yeah. David, beyond the getting out of your own way, what's some of those like hurdles or like investing challenges that you really faced that you had to get over that you came across just to be able to get to the next level, so to speak, whatever that next level would be for you? Because everybody's next level is going to be different for each individual.
Yeah, I'm in a weird spot with my investing where a lot of what I'm doing right now is more network driven. So I'm, you know, whether that's raising capital for big deals or that's putting people together and getting a small piece of the pie. Or, you know, I'm on a kind of a wholesale team and I come in when there's an option for a potential creative finance deal. And, you know, I'm kind of the piece of the puzzle that it's like, oh, well, here, let me negotiate that stuff with you. So it really kind of depends. Like I'm playing a lot into my strengths as a people person and trying to build via connecting. And I think that's a lot easier for me than it was when I was trying to, you know, if I'm in ops, something's wrong. And I was trying to do ops. That was my biggest hurdle. I was trying to do ops. Like I had a property manager, but I tried to flip a house while I was stationed in another state. And I didn't want to hire an ops guy because I didn't want to pay the money. So I was like, I can handle this. And I lost 30 grand. I tried to take down a really big deal, probably bigger than I should have bid off. And instead of bringing my known property manager in, I trusted the one that was there. And instead of bringing my team in, I trusted the team that was there and it didn't work out for me. And so I've learned, you know, I think some of the biggest hurdles are really just like, you know, the old trust but verify. Like I'm way too trusting. And so I have to know, like, this is the team that I work with. This is the team that I know will have my back. So this is the team I'm bringing in regardless. And then really just understanding that you do need boots on the ground. And if it's not going to be you, then you've got to find someone it can be and put that piece together. And so like the perfect example is this RV park. I have an RV park. It's like 30 pads, something like that. And I'm a 10% owner, not huge, but I got a phone call. Hey, I got this incredible deal. I need 100K. Do you know anyone? And I knew someone. So I was like, you know, you give me 5% and I'll get you the money. And he's like, yeah, of course. And then the other guy was like, let's give him 10%. And I was like, oh, all right, cool. But I made one phone call, guy liked it. And so now it's the three of us in this RV park. And really all I've done with it, other than put the money partner, the lender and the LLC creation, you know, those are all my team. So I had my guys do it. Other than bringing all those people in, I've done the Google business page and some reviews and that's basically it. So yeah, it's been good.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So the pads though, that's a really, really interesting. There's a overnight RV park not far from me that I've been pretty interested on. It's right next to an interstate. So it's like, it's a constant hub and we have a pipeline going in. So there's welders in there all the time and they just rotate in and out and it is always full. I've been considering looking into those just for that, not alone. So pretty interesting.
Yeah, we kind of just stumbled across it, but the numbers worked. So why not? You know, we bought it at 480. We've got it currently renting for like 10 grand a month on average. So some are lower, obviously, but it was also only open 9 months a year. And we've got it open all 12. So
yeah, a lot of opportunity for growth right off the bat.
Yeah. Yeah. It was poorly managed enough that when they listed it as a single family house. And the reason we found it is my buddy was like, why is this? What is this? There's no single family houses that are that much in this area. Like, well, this has to be a mistake. And then he starts looking and he's like, oh, it's a mistake, but it's not the kind I thought. He assumed it was just way overpriced. He's like, oh, no, there's a whole RV park back there and a shop and another shop. And, you know, they had it listed as just the single wide 3-2. And there is a single wide 3-2, but as well as, you know, now like 35 spots if you count the tent camping. And there's we turned one of the shops into a 2-1. And a laundromat. So yeah.
The laundromat. That was smart.
I mean, it's just enough for like the RV park, but it brings in, you know, a couple extra bucks here and there, 20, 30 bucks a month or what, probably more than that, but probably more like 50 bucks, 100 bucks a month.
Man, that's awesome, man. That's awesome. And David, like, you know, one of the things we was speaking about, like before we started the show, we were kind of, you know, figure out, okay, so what do people need to get to that next level? And there's so many different things, but sometimes, you know, people, after they buy their first one or two properties, they're out of money and they don't know what to do next. I know I was right there too. After I bought my first two properties, I don't have any more money left. And I just, you know, didn't know what to do to go to that next level. But I know that you've done a lot of things to go to the next level. And you've helped a lot of people as well to get to that next level. What would you say is something that could be very helpful for investors who are like, you know, I feel stuck and, you know, I need to get to that next level, but I don't know what to do. I want to continue investing. I want to continue scaling my business.
Yeah, I think the money piece is the easiest piece to solve if you're a decent human. So if you, the problem is people don't like to talk about what they're doing. Like there's this like, oh man, if I'm showing this off, it's bragging or it's, you know, whatever. You got to share what you're doing. And if you start sharing what you're doing online, you're going to have people that follow you around. Your family's going to be curious. People are going to ask you about it. And if you, every time someone asks how you're doing or what you're up to, say saying like, oh, same old, you're like, oh, you know, crushing this aspect of real estate, you're going to open doors to conversations and people have money. And there are plenty of people out there, whether it's an IRA or a, you know, a life insurance policy or their bank account, that would much rather hand you money at a set return or with an equity stake and let you run with it than throw it in the stock market and not know what's going to happen. Not to say that the stock market's a bad bet, but that's a thing. So I think, you know, being able to raise capital just from telling people what you're doing is huge. But then the other big piece of that puzzle is like the creative side. I mean, there's so many unique ways to buy. We bought 5 houses on tax liens this year for $16,000. And one of two things will happen. We either get paid back on those plus interest, or we get 5 houses for $16,000 that what? Aren't just going to be in great shape, you know?
Wait a second. Hold a second. Did you just say 5 houses for $16,000?
Yeah, not each total.
Oh my God. Even if it was each, that would still be good.
Yeah. So like tax liens. Wow. You know? I mean, now the thing is you show up at the courthouse, you bid on them, you land them, they've got a year to repay you. So maybe 2 or 3 of them will repay you, but you know, they repay you plus 10% interest for the money. And then, 10% interest for the money that was the original tax lien. If you bid over that, you don't get a return on that part, but it's still whatever. You still get a return. You're still guaranteed to either get all your money back plus a little bit or a house, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then the other piece is like actual creative financing stuff. And you know, people talk about creative financing and seller financing and sub 2 and all this. And there's a lot of investors that get the idea that means you just run around and poke people at the MLS or wherever and say, will you take seller financing? Are you open to owner? Are you open to this? And the problem is when you do that, the only people who are going to say yes are going to be people who know what it is because they're investors and they're going to make terms up that are, you know, favorable for them. And they're going to be like, yeah, here, if you do this, they're going to be like 20% down, 8% interest, 3-year, like all whatever. But if you go into those properties, especially if you're doing like direct to seller conversations instead of MLS, and you just figure out what they need, you know, what they're, if the price is a sticking point, if moving's a sticking point, if wanting to stay in the house for 2 months is a sticking, whatever the sticking point is, you can solve that in almost every situation with some kind of a creative financing option. And you don't even have to be like, oh, are you open to seller financing? You're just like, well, hey, what if I gave you the $10,000 you need at closing and then made the rest of it to you in monthly payments? So you made $200 a month for the next 10 years. How would that sound? Like, oh, that sounds great. Okay, cool. Well, you just structured a seller financing deal, but you didn't use all the fancy terms. Cause you know, the problem is when you go to a homeowner, like grandma doesn't know what seller financing is. Grandma knows what listing her property on the MLS is. And so if you start bringing up fancy investor terminology, you scare grandma off. But if you're like, oh, you're trying to move to Miami next week and you need $10,000. And then after that, you'd like a little bit of cash flow. Cool. Well, hey, I'll buy your $70,000 house for $10,000 down. And then I'll pay you $600 a month for the next 120 months. How's that sound? And she's like, oh, that sounds great. I'm like, cool. Well, the mortgage is only, you know, if there is a mortgage, you know, you'd back that out and they get that much. But if there's not a mortgage, then they get $600 a month for the next 10 years, which if you do the math on that is a 0% interest carry. And you didn't have to go, how would you like to lend it to me at 0%? Because nobody's going to say yes to that, but you're solving a problem. So yeah, that's my ramble.
How are you doing your direct to seller marketing?
I'm not doing as much right now. I'm a huge direct mail fan. I like cold callers as well. I think texting is dead. I don't know if it's dead, but I think it's just not worth the hassle right now. Too many people are getting sued. And so I like direct mail and, you know, cold calls for the most part. And then, you know, I do a lot of try to do SEO or pay-per-lead. So SEO being, you know, just having a website where we pop up when people search for wholesalers in our area or selling their house in our area. And then pay-per-lead being, you know, basically paying a company that specializes in SEO, like, hey, whenever you get a lead, we'll pay for it. That's a little bit pricier per lead for sure, but you also aren't paying a cost hoping you get leads. You're paying when there is a lead. So
So are you finding a creative type of seller deals or creative financing deals through these direct methods like mail and calls and everything?
Yeah. I mean, I my first one was it was on the MLS. I actually found it via direct mail, but it was listed on the MLS at the time, and we were still able to pull it off as a creative deal. But then most of my other ones have been from direct to seller. We've bought like two houses where we were just a little bit off on the price and we were going to flip the house instead of wholesale it. And so we were like, hey, look, if you really are set on that price, we can give it to you, but are you okay with letting us finish the renovation and then paying you on the back end? And so we bought it zero down, no interest and no payments for the first 12 months. And then we finished flipping the house. And when we finished flipping the house, they got paid out of the sale.
Dude, that's okay. Wow. That's so I love it. I think that's right. That right there is what our listeners want to hear. Can you like break down that process? Like what was the steps to you getting that property and what was that like? I think this is a really good point, really, right now to take notes.
Can you
give it step by step with that? That sounds pretty juicy.
Yeah, we'll say that's not intentional. This is just the whole thing with creative financing, you just having options in your back pocket, right? So we'll use the first one just to have a specific example. This property was on Walnut. Guy wanted like 55 or 50, but it had a grease fire in the kitchen. The whole house was blacked out and there was no way anybody was paying that. And he knew that because he'd been trying to sell it kind of for like 6 months and people just kept lowballing him and he was getting fed up. And I was like, dude, like ideally we're at like 28 grand. Our best offer is 32. Like, I'm just going to be up front with you. Like I appreciate everything. You know, he was pretty straight shooter. So I was like, I'm not even going to negotiate on this. Like, this is where I'd like to be, but 32 is my max allowable offer. So I know that's a way off. If that doesn't work, I get it. He's like, I could go all the way to 38. And I'm like, there's no way. You know, I was like, he was at 40. We got him to 38. And I was like, that's still a really big gap. And I'm trying to figure out, like, can we wholesale it? Like, there's not much meat on the bones because I knew people weren't going to pay 50. So if we wholesaled it, we might make a few thousand dollars. But I like the location. It's a great location. And so we basically said, look, dude, if you're dead set on 38, I'd love to give it to you. There's no way I can do that up front and have to pay interest on that amount without breaking the bank. But if you want the 38, I can do it. Are you okay with the idea of basically seller financing it and we pay you at the end of 12 months in a balloon note? So instead of like monthly payments for 5 years or, you know, right now, it's like you just got to wait a little bit and 12 months down the road, you get the full check. And he was like, yeah, I'm okay with that. So now ultimately he forgot about property taxes. And so we ended up bringing $623 or something like that to the closing table to take care of the taxes for the year. But just because I wasn't going to force at that point he thought we were paying him, which was definitely not in the contract. But I was like, I'm not losing this deal over $600 in property taxes. So we brought $630 or whatever to the closing table. And then, you know, we took that thing and ran with it and we renovated it and we sold it. And unfortunately, I will say we went past the 12 month mark. So I ended up cutting him a check at month 12 and then we closed the sale at like 13 and a half. So it wasn't too bad. I was only out the money for a month and a half as opposed to, you know, but that was just, I learned a lot about that one just because it was a big fire renovation. So like the city kept getting involved with codes and inspections and all kinds of crap. And that was a pain, but the deal was still great. Like we still had 12 months there where we weren't paying interest on 38 grand while we were renovating the property. And had we finished it within that timeline, you know, we would have just paid him at closing.
Man. Wow. That's awesome.
That's a great idea. Like if you're real tight. So I had a creative finance deal where I had another investor wanted to sell me this house. He was liquidating to get into something larger. And he was selling to me at a discount and I could add value and so on and so forth. Well, I called my private money guy and said, hey, would you do this? And he was like, yeah, I'll give you X amount. And then we got down to kind of the wire and pulling the trigger on it. I was like, man, I'm down by 10 grand. Like it just is just the time of year and everything. It was just that 10 grand I couldn't produce it. So I went to the seller and said, hey man, this is not working out. I'm going to have to pass on the deal. And he goes, well, how much do you need? And I said, 10 grand. And he said, well, how about $50 a month for 5 months on the 10 grand? You pay that off. And he's like, I make a couple extra $100 and he's like, you're good for it. There you go. And sure enough, and it worked and ended up refining that property and I'm in $0. It was a pretty deal actually, but creative financing was absolutely for the win on that one.
Yeah. Yeah. It's often, if you have good rapport with the seller, they would rather just work with you than farm it out and have a million people walk through. Like there's a lot of ways to pull it off. We've done a few interesting deals where we either had 100% creative financing, or, you know, they carried a second so I could use my bank for the main loan. Or the first one I ever did, the one that I mentioned kind of earlier, I was looking for duplexes with direct mail. And the guy came back and was like, oh, I don't want to sell you my duplex, but I have a 10 unit, but it's on the market. And we went back and forth and back and forth. And we came down on price, and then had something come up in inspections and this, that, and the other. Anyway, basically we ended up closing it at 85% bank financing, 10% seller. And I brought five. So wow. I brought,
that's great.
Yeah, this was early 2017, 2018. So pricing has obviously changed, but we bought it for $212,500, and my down payment was like $10,990. And then 4 years to the day later, I sold it for $340 and made, you know, $125,000, $130,000 plus whatever I'd made in cash flow over the last 4 years. So pretty wow. sick deal.
That's oh my awesome. God, David, that's just amazing. And I appreciate you sharing that deal and all these deals you've been doing, because, you know, people need to hear that there's ways to break through that next level, right? You don't have to just do the traditional way, you know, working a job and, you know, saving up 20%, 25% or whatever, and then buying, you know, one property every 5 years or whatever, however long it takes you. So thank you for sharing that, man. I think our listeners are going to enjoy those practical steps that you gave too, man. Man, This has been completely amazing. There's so much more to talk about. I think, William, we may even have to like bring him on. There's so many different like topics here. We may have to like
Him back
to unpack everything. And still, we probably wouldn't unpack everything. But, you know, David, he has a lot of different ways that you can learn more things. But, you know, more than likely, you know, for this show, David, maybe we missed something. Is there anything that we missed so our audience can become a breakthrough investor just like you?
I mean, we talked about a lot of the big stuff, you know, kind of getting out there so people know what you're doing, so you can raise money, networking, scaling, building a team. I mean, we surface level talked about all that. The creative finance piece, I would just reiterate, creative financing works when you care about the people and what they need and you solve their problems. It doesn't work when you're just running around trying to treat it as a type of financing.
That's good, man. And I love how you mention, you know, try to solve problems, right? And what I'm hearing you say too, putting in my own words, is, you know, don't just make it about you, make it about them and how you could solve their problems. And maybe you can come to some sort of win-win situation with them. So man, this is awesome, man. So David, you know, people are also going to want to find out more about you. They're going to listen to you and hear more. How can they find you and how can they connect with you online?
Yeah, they can go to thebestpodcastguest.com. And if you go to that website, it has a free link to download a PDF of my book. And then it has links to all my social media. So that's the easiest little hub for all your info.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you so much, David. It's been great to have you on the show. And we'll see you at RubeCon next year, right?
Yeah. I'll be speaking.
Awesome. Fantastic.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to it. Well, let's definitely connect more at RubeCon.